second side of the third tape interviewing Rabbi Leonard Winograd of McKeesport. Okay, you're going to explain that title your dissertation.
All right, Emanuel Glosser's father, whose name I can't remember now, I should, but I can't, Moses Glosser, they were living in Caldersport on a farm. They were farmers. And Emanuel had wanderlust. He was a young boy, and he was going from town to town buying junk and shipping it up to the family, where they would sell it and get money out of it. And he at Barnesboro found a lot of junk, and he heard there was junk here and junk there, and he got down to Somerset. My God, the junk in Somerset. And he sent a telegram for the family to sell everything and come down to Somerset to live. And they were on a wagon, and they were on their way to Somerset when they got as far as Windburn, and that's where the horse died.
Oh, literally died at Windburn.
And that's where the family stayed. And that's why I called my book The Horse Died at Windburn.
Now, is Windburn like a suburb of Johnstown?
Very close to Johnstown.
I see.
Yeah, that's... Johnstown is such a... It's really a town in a class by itself. The first three movie Tarzans were from Johnstown.
Really?
Because, you know, in Johnstown, people take swimming damn seriously. Because they've had 11 or 12 real floods there. They don't fool around when they talk about swimming in Johnstown. Johnny Weissmuller was born in Windburn. And they tell me the names of these other fellows, but the first three movie Tarzans came from Johnstown.
That's quite a record.
Yes, that's fantastic. Okay. Listen, it was... Johnstown was a wonderful place to be a rabbi because, for the most part, Jews were not welcome in country clubs. So everything went into the temple and the synagogue. And the temple and the synagogue, there were no other Jewish buildings there. You didn't have a Jewish community center, and you didn't have a B'nai B'rith home like we had in Beaver Falls when I grew up. You didn't have Jewish war veterans except in name only. So it was really nice. And then little by little Jews were taken into country. But I remember when the first Jewish people were invited in the Sunny Hill Country Club, was a young doctor came, made an appointment with me. Want to know if it would be permissible for him to join.
He asked your permission.
Yeah, he wanted what was the right thing to do.
And what did you advise him?
I told him that if you want to join that club, by all means join. But if you are going to join just to make a point that Jews can join this club, forget it. And don't do it to make them happy. Okay? We had a policy, my wife and I, of never going to anything at this particular club. And the Chamber of Commerce every year, had a big dinner to welcome new executives to town, and they invited me to be the speaker, and I accepted, of course. And the dinner was to be at this particular country club, and they told me, and I said I wouldn't go. They asked me why, and I told them. And I said, he said, what should I tell the board? I said, you tell them that I wouldn't set foot in that club if they had Adolf Hitler singing Kol Nidre. And my wife was president of Hadassah, of course. She always is wherever we live. And they had a big thing every year at that club for the presidents of the various women's organizations. And ultimately, the policy changed. And there were always good people inside these restricted clubs who want to change it. And I believe you help them by staying the hell away from the club. And showing them that their policy is really insulting to you, and you're not going to go to people who insult you. Johnstown then, and I think now, is an exceptionally fine place to raise people. Friends of mine from New York described it as a Shangri-La. But it was a great place to raise kids. And
You had all of your children by the time you left Johnstown.
Well, he had a brand new baby when we left there.
Mm-hmm.
And we came here where I could have known the facts when I came, but I really didn't.
The facts about McKeesport?
About
you mean?
How serious the decline was.
You got here in what year, Rabbi? Hmm? 60.
What's 13 from 82? 69.
69.
People did try. Dr. Harry Wexler came out to Johnstown and tried to show me that McKeesport's a bigger town, but the problem with not having enough children is just as serious. But I didn't listen. I saw that beautiful big building, you know, and I had a McKeesport in my mind. It's like the Jerusalem that a Zionist has in his mind. He doesn't see the real one. He sees the one that he was taught in school. The McKeesport in my mind was from the AZA and from PAFDI. This was the biggest youth group at any function. Anywhere. Camp Harlem. There'd be five kids there from Johnstown. There'd be 50 from McKeesport.
And what era were you talking about these figures?
Oh, just a couple years before I came here.
In the early 60s?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
As one of the things that happened while I was in Johnstown is that I spent a number of years as rabbinic advisor to Western PAFDI. And we started to spend our summers at Camp Harlem, which is wonderful. And the McKeesport youth group was always the biggest, and they didn't talk to anybody else. And not because they were snobbish, because they were Hungarian. They couldn't speak English.
Was this primarily a Hungarian community?
This is it. This is it. The Pope is Catholic. McKeesport is the center of Hungarian Jewry for the Western Hemisphere. In case you didn't know that. Seriously.
You're really not serious.
I am quite serious.
What made them come to McKeesport?
I'll never know that. I'll never know that. In the in 1916, I think I mentioned this before, maybe I did, there was an article in the Jewish Criterion about McKeesport that said that the basis of the Jewish community in McKeesport was 1,500 Hungarian Jews who came here to work as laborers in the steel mills, much as Italians went to Barnesboro to work in the coal mines. I've never been able to verify that figure, but I want you to know that last week I had two funerals, and both men had at one time or another worked in steel mills. And of course, both Hungarian. I knew that McKeesport was a Hungarian town long before I ever moved here.
Are there still manifestations of that? I mean, that you can tell how, what?
Well, the Hungarian Jews celebrate at weddings with a whole heart in a way that we never did. We were Litvaks. And we were, I don't know, maybe uptight is the word, maybe self-conscious, but the Hungarian Jews have an abandon at weddings. It's just a great pleasure to see. Hungarian Jews have very warm family life and very very close family ties. We have, we're Flemish, but when you're with Hungarian Jews, you're with close family.
What accounts for a decline?
Here? Oh, that's... You've got, in all small towns, first place, the population of Western Pennsylvania is declining, okay? And Jews are people. B, you have in all small towns the Jewish boys and girls who grow up, go to college, and go find work elsewhere. American people, for the most part, are leaving Western Pennsylvania to live in the Southwest. If not in the Southwest, certainly in the South. I have a son living in Atlanta. When I see what he's living in, who wouldn't want to? Okay? But there's another factor. We have a lot of young men and women who were raised in our congregation who are working in McKeesport, but they're living in the new areas, meaning Pleasant Hills, Mount Lebanon, Churchill. They're easily accessible to McKeesport to work here, and I don't blame them to want to live in new houses and new places.
What is the composition of your congregation now? How many families?
I think we're about 240 families, which is pretty much what it was when I came here.
But fewer children, you're saying?
Oh, we have a high percentage of single-person families, meaning widows and widowers.
Is it primarily an older congregation, would you say?
Yes. If you would read our temple bulletin, you'll find every month a lot of people celebrating major special birthdays, 70, 75, 80, 85. In May, we have a woman going to celebrate her 100th birthday, whose home I ate in when I was an AZA boy and came here to play basketball. But, we have a lot of... We have classes where a lot of the children come from divorced homes. We have classes where a majority of the children come from families where either the mother or father was not born Jewish. I don't mean to say we have a lot of intermarriage. I mean, we have classes where the majority are intermarriages. This ultimately will affect what is said in sermons at temple. I don't know that you consciously talk differently to a person because they are a convert. But if you're talking to a room full of converts, it has to affect you.
Do you think you have a higher proportion of this kind of family background than would be true of a congregation in a large city?
I don't know. I guess because in the nicest possible way, no one gets away from you without a fight. If I told you we've lost only one family in 15 years, there were others who tried to resent it. And I went after them and I made the mistake as we needed. When I hear of a Jewish boy marrying a Gentile girl, I try to give them an attempt very hard.
What happens at the actual ceremony? What is your policy on that?
I don't do mixed marriages. That's point A. Point B, I invite them to come and sit down and talk to me. I try to explain to the Gentile partner what happened to us with Hitler and how desperately we need all the children who could be born to us. And if they are Catholic, I explain to them that the Catholics really do not need you the way we do. We need the children who will be born in this marriage. I don't think anyone has ever, at that point, told me those children couldn't be raised Jewish. Then the next step is, see, there are a lot of steps between rejection and acceptance. Next is to try to get the Gentile partner to agree to take a course for conversion without any obligation to convert.
And where is this course?
Right here in my living room.
I see.
I have two people this morning, and this evening I'll have three.
So you do a lot of that then?
Yes. And
do you find a high rate of acceptance when you offer this or suggest this?
Yes. I find that more often than not, without any obligation to convert, the Gentile will offer to convert. When I say you're not obligated to convert, that means I can't ever say to them, I want you to convert. They're just taking the course. But at some point near the end, they will say, when will my conversion be? Not always, but more often than not.
How long a course do you offer?
13 weeks, 1 hour a week. And I do have them learn to read Hebrew and to translate basic prayers. I use a lot of programming material, self-teaching material, much of which I wrote myself.
That's a lot to accomplish in 13 weeks.
Yeah, but you're talking about adults. My wife learned to read Hebrew in an hour because her husband was going to be a rabbi. So we were in Cincinnati, and she said, I think if I'm going to be a Robinson, I better learn to read Hebrew. So I sat down with her and taught her Hebrew. It took an hour. And if a person is really motivated, that in Framingham, there was a little girl whose father was in the Air Force. He was going overseas to Germany. And I taught her the Hebrew alphabet in an hour and a half, 10 years old. But that she was motivated. She had to learn. She wasn't going to learn it in Germany. You know, you can do these things. So, above all, I guess the problem is to understand we live in an open society which we really created. I created it as much as anybody on the face of the earth. I wanted the society to be open. I really believe in freedom, and I wanted the freedom to be here for my children and for myself. My parents believed in it very much. Okay? I mean, my father, to the extent that he thought it was wrong for me to join the Jewish War Veterans. He said, you should join the American Legion of the Veterans of Foreign Wars. Why should you be in a separate veterans organization? Having created an open society, there's got to be a certain amount of Jewish boys and girls meeting Gentile boys and girls and falling in love. It may be that 6 months after they're married, they've got to have a divorce. But when they get married, that's what they want and that's what they're going to get. And if you don't give it to them, they'll get it for something else. And I've seen the people who didn't get married because I wouldn't marry them. But I think that was one couple in all these years. And neither one could convert to the other faith because of peculiar personal things.
What philosophy are you giving your children about this as you raise them? Some of yours are married now, right?
One is married.
Right.
I have explained to them that I know that our relatives, meaning aunts and uncles and cousins, would never approve of these things. I don't really care whether they approve of it or not. But I am sure that I would never do anything to hurt the Jewish people. And I really believe that mixed marriage hurts the Jewish people. Now that's mixed marriage as contrasted with intermarriage, assuming that intermarriage means that the conversion has taken place. And I have seen plenty of synagogues where rabbis are not very gung-ho about conversion, but the leading women in their congregations are converts. And once you send a child out into a free society, next step is that you have to know that if they come home with somebody who is not Jewish, your child is not a criminal. The other fellow's child is not a criminal. They're not indecent people. They're not evil people. and it may be damned inconvenient for you, but what they have done is probably not too different from what you would have done if you had lived when they are living. And what you owe to them is understanding and help, and not to close the door on them. And that with love and also, you know, one of my kids one time brought a girl home who wasn't Jewish. He wasn't really serious about her, but she really loved him. You could see it. Now, how could I blame her? I love him. I think he's a lovable person. And I'm going to tell this girl, you can't love this man. Who couldn't love him? So, without falsifying the world you live in, saying things that are absurd, whenever I conduct a funeral, I come back to the house with the family, and I explain that among the reasons for eating an egg after a funeral, one of which is that the egg is, according to the rabbis, an animal without a mouth, that you shouldn't articulate everything you eat, because a lot of it isn't you at that moment. It's your disappointment, your bitterness, your unhappiness, your sickness. And 6 months from now, you'll feel like a jerk if you say everything you feel today. So I'll say it for you. And I say these things. Well, that's true also in these stressful situations of a world in transition. I once heard a kid explain that it's like you're riding a merry-go-round, and every time you turn around, they move the brass ring to a different place. You don't know what to pull. And the world is changing. I swear the world didn't change this fast when I was a kid. It was a really stable world. The teams that were in the National League and American League in baseball stayed the thing for, what, 30, 40, 50 years. They never changed. So
you're trying to be willing to be flexible and change with the world.
I'm trying to be flexible, I have to, you know. I believe very strongly that a religion that people cannot live by in a changed world, either the people will die or the religion. You can't live by a religion because of changes. And yes, you have to change with it. But I expect, fully knowing my children, that were they to marry Gentiles, that the Gentiles would convert. I would expect also that having grown up in McKeesport, although they are very Jewish children, they have spent most of their playtime with Gentiles. Would be very comfortable with.
Okay, can I ask you that? Two things. What kind of impact do you think the Jews have had on a city like McKeesport, or specifically on McKeesport? And what do you see as the, aside from perhaps the interrelations that lead to perhaps a lot more intermarriage here, what are the relations like within the community between Jews and Christians?
I could only speak for myself on these things. You have occasionally the Jewish person who is on the school board, the Jewish person who is on the town council, that sort of thing. Now, those things are spectacular. I don't know that they are significant. Yet, Jews can get elected to public office in these towns. Okay? I don't know that Jews have been of tremendous impact in this community. I don't think so. Nor were they where I came from. Uh, Glassport, they named the public library for Sammy Weiss. I don't think there's anything like that in McKeesport. I conduct maybe 8 or 9 seders a year. Most of them are in churches, both Catholic and Protestant. It's good. It's getting better. I hope that means that if the economy ever reaches the point that people want to kill Jews, it will save some of our lives.
Is that a particular problem in the peace court?
What, satyrs?
No, anti-Semitism.
You know, honey, I don't travel in those circles. So,
it's really your congregation.
These are not those times. These are not those times. When you get into this area, it's very difficult to factor the thing out. 2 years ago, I was getting threatening letters threatening to kill me and to blow up my temple and this kind of stuff. The man was not an anti-Semite. He was crazy. But to read the letters, they sounded anti-Semitic. Okay.
They were able to track these down?
Yeah, okay. They were able to find them. Mm-hmm. I would like to say this about myself and McKeesport, though. I would like for McKeesport not to have gone into numerical decline when I got here. I wish it had grown as rapidly as Framingham grew. I would like to have been rabbi of a very large congregation and been making a lot more money. But aside from that, I have a very good marriage with this community, with this congregation. In all the really important things, I'm very happy. For several years, this year I didn't do it. I taught a course in Torah translation on Thursdays to Christian ministers here in my home. We have a very lovely interfaith group of clergy who meet for lunch once a month, and because we like each other. And above all, I'm the kind of person who deeply appreciates the pageantry and the music of Judaism, and this is an extremely traditional congregation as Reformed congregations grow, and I fit in just perfectly here, and I have a totally free hand with the liturgy and with the music, and it's a real joy for me.
Well, that's something you couldn't predict before you came either. I think we've really come up to 1982 with you. We really thank you for taking 3 separate hours and plus the extra time that one session with us, and this, you realize, is going to be used as a reference. We're going to index this so that if scholars are wanting to study anything relevant to any of the material here, it will be handy for them. Mm-hmm. And we really thank you.
Well, I'd like to tell the scholars who study this how sweet you ladies have been. And how much I've enjoyed being with you. I had once an idea to write memoirs, and I never did anything about it.
It's never too late.
But talking to you, I realized how true the title was that I picked out for it, which was Chess on a Checkerboard. You know, there's 2 different games you can play on that board, chess and checkers. One day I realized I was really playing a different game than the rest of the world. And
I think we're going to encourage you to do exactly that, because I think there are a lot more stories there that we didn't really even tap.
Yep. You got space?
Eileen, how's the time? Well, try.
When I was captured, it was a hard time for my parents because I was listed missing in action. One day, my father was asleep. A bird flew in the window and bit him on the hand. And he pushed the bird away. The bird flew back in the window and bit him on the hand. And he pushed the bird away, and it flew back in and bit him on the hand. And he forgot my smile. He told my mother, "My boy is all right." That was April 29th, the day our camp was liberated.
Oh, my goodness.
And whenever he would see people on the street, he'd say, "My boy is all right. A little bird, he told me so."
Is that a true story?
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
You're a psychic family.
Yeah, a psycho family. I just happened to, I have never told the story till last Friday night. I remember it because I was preaching about birds. I was thinking of stories about birds, and that one came to mind.
Well, that's too good a story to lose.
Well,
we're going to encourage you to write your memoirs, and we want to be among the first to read them when you do them.
I sure hope I can send it through the mail. If not, I'll deliver it first.
Fair enough. Well, we thank you.
Okay.